Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're embarking on an exploration into Yarsinism, a really distinct religious tradition with deep roots in Western Iran and parts of Iraq.
Yes, and you've gathered quite an extensive collection of research here. Our aim today, I think, is to really unpack this tradition. You might know it as Ali Haq or Kakai, to get a handle on its core beliefs, its practices, and importantly, the real challenges it faces today.
There's a lot to cover.
There really is. We're looking at everything from possible pre-Islamic origins right through to these unique theological ideas and its current situation, often as a marginalized community. So our task is to sort of navigate all this and pull out the most crucial, most compelling aspects for our listeners.
Okay, so where's the best place to start? Origins, perhaps.
I think so. The research suggests Yarsinism is what we call a syncretic faith. Basically, it means it's a tradition that's blended elements from lots of different older beliefs. Think of it like a spiritual mosaic.
Right, pulling from different sources.
Exactly. We can see influences from pre-Islamic Iranian religions, possibly Mithraism, maybe Zoroastrianism, and there are Judeo-Christian elements woven in there too.
So definitely not something that just popped up in isolation.
Not at all. And the sources also point to strong links with Islamic mysticism, you know, Sufism especially. There are even shared features with some medieval groups sometimes called extremist Shiite or Gulat.
Gulat.
Yeah, these are groups that had, let's say, particularly elevated views of certain figures in early Islam. And some scholars see connections there, part of Yarsinism's early doctrinal layers. What's fascinating isn't just that it borrowed things, but how it wove them together, creating something really unique. It shows this remarkable adaptability, maybe even a deliberate effort to connect with a diverse culture.
And is there a point where this mix of beliefs really solidified into what we now call Yarsinism?
Well, the research points to the late 14th century CE as a key moment. That's when Sultan Sayyak is credited with formally establishing the religion. It's like its official starting point as a defined entity.
Okay, Sultan Sayyak. And it has several names. Yarsan, Ali Haq, Kakai. What's the story behind those?
Good question. Yarsan is sometimes thought to mean companions of the Sultan, linking back to Sultan Sayyak. Ali Haq is pretty clear people of truth. That really speaks to their core belief.
And Kakayu.
That's used more often in Iraq. And it means something like members of the brotherhood, emphasizing the community aspect. Then there's Ali Alahi, worshippers of Ali. That's more of an external label, though.
Because they highly respect Ali.
Exactly. But many Yarsanis actually reject that term because, well, it oversimplifies their beliefs. It's not just about Ali. You'll even find people referring to adherents by their tribal names sometimes.
It sounds like even the names tell a complex story.
They really do. And interestingly, one source mentions the Turkoman Korakoyunlu period, mid-15th century, as maybe being a significant time for the religion's development, perhaps because there was so much cultural mixing going on then.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah?
Roj Bosh. Yeah. Lovely.
Oh, this smells wonderful today. It's got that perfect cardamom aroma. You know, sometimes Hannah's chai can be a little bitter if she's not careful with the brewing time, but today, sips. Ah, spot on. Yeah. Just the right amount of sweetness, too. It's definitely a good chai day. We needed this little break.
Smells great. Perfect timing. Sips. Yes, very good today.
Okay, feeling refreshed. So we've touched on origins and names. Now, this cyclical view of history you mentioned with the four epochs, Shariat, Tariqat, Marifat, and Hakikat. Can you unpack that a bit? It sounds really central.
It absolutely is. It's fundamental to how Yarsanis see the world and time. They understand history unfolding in these four distinct stages, and crucially, each state has a primary divine manifestation.
Okay, walk us through them.
Right, so the first epoch is Shariat, or law. This runs from Adam up to the Prophet Muhammad, and the Creator is the divine presence there. Then comes the second, Tariqat, the path or doctrine. This goes until the time of a figure called Shah Koshin, and Ali ibn Abi Talib is the central manifestation.
Ali again, right.
Yes. The third epoch is Marifat Gnosis, or mystical knowledge. This leads up to Sultan Sayyak, and Shah Koshin is the main divine figure for this period. And finally, the fourth epoch, which is Hakikat, or truth. This starts with Sultan Sayyak and continues right up to today. He's the pivotal divine manifestation for this current age.
So it's like a progression. Each stage builds on the last, revealing more.
That's a great way to put it. It's a progressive unfolding of divine truth. And for Yarsanis, it reaches its highest point, its full revelation, with Sultan Sayyak in this fourth epoch. It's a powerful narrative that really positions their faith as the culmination of spiritual understanding.
Sultan Sahak is clearly incredibly important then.
Absolutely central. He's revered as Sultan Hakikat and Fiyawan Karam, the highest spiritual rank. His tomb in Purdivar is a major sanctuary, real focal point for pilgrimage.
And the stories around his birth are quite something, aren't they? The virgin birth story, the pomegranate seed.
Yes, that's a very prominent tradition. His mother, Dayrak Rusbar, consuming a pomegranate seed. Her lineage is also traced to the Barzanji Sufi family, which again shows those links to mysticism.
And there are other more speculative links.
Right, people sometimes connect him to ancient figures like the Median ruler Dahak, or even the Sufi Saint Haji Bektash, but those are much more debated, less certain. The fact that these different stories exist just highlights the richness and maybe the internal diversity of their history.
And figures like Ali, Shakoshin, and Baba Yadgar, they're also key divine manifestations in their respective epochs.
Precisely. Ali in the second, Shakoshin in the third, and Baba Yadgar, often seen as an incarnation of Hussein bin Ali, is highly revered. He's also interesting because he's listed as one of Sultan Sahak's key companions in the fourth epoch, so there's this continuity.
Which brings us to the Haftan, the Holy Seven. That seems like a constant feature.
It is. It's like a recurring council, you could say. The specific individuals change depending on the epoch, but the concept of this group of seven holy beings is always there. In Sultan Sahak's time, it included figures like Pir Benjamin, Pir Muzi, Mustafa Dewan, Daud Kaswar, Baba Yadgar, and Khatun Erezbar, Sultan Sahak's mother.
So it's like a foundational spiritual structure that adapts across time.
That's a good way to think about it. A core spiritual architecture underpinning each era of divine revelation.
Okay, so we've got the historical roots, the key figures. Let's shift now to the core theological beliefs, the things that really define Yarsinism and maybe set it apart. This idea of successive divine manifestations, for instance, that's quite different from mainstream Islamic monotheism, isn't it?
It really is. It's probably the most significant theological difference. Yarsinists believe the divine essence, what they call Haq, takes physical form repeatedly through history in these figures, the Mazariyat. Mainstream Islam, on the other hand, emphasizes God's absolute transcendence, you know, no incarnations.
So for Yarsinis, the divine isn't just out there, it's actively present in history through these people.
Exactly. That concept is absolutely central. If you want to grasp their core belief, that's key, the divine making itself known within the world in physical form.
And what about their cosmology, this idea of inner and outer worlds?
Right, the Batini and the Ohiri realities. They see these two worlds as interconnected. But the inner spiritual world, the Batini, is considered the true reality, the one that governs the outer physical world we see.
And accessing that inner truth isn't straightforward?
No, it's not immediately obvious. It's believed to be accessible through their sacred texts, the Kalams, and through individuals who've reached a high level of spiritual understanding, the Daidadar. It's like there's a deeper truth beneath the surface of everyday life.
Their creation story sounds quite unique, too, with the pearl.
It's very rich, symbolically. The universal spirit contained within a pearl called Aza. Then the creation of the first Haftan, this primordial meeting or jam, the sacrifice of a celestial bull or deer. And ultimately, the pearl bursts, forming the world. It's a profound narrative.
And that creation story connects to the cyclical view of time. Each epoch sort of replays creation.
Precisely. Each dower or epoch is seen as a reenactment of that original creation. This provides the basis for the divine manifestations appearing and also for their belief in reincarnation, Dun Adan, which is crucial.
And there's an end times element too.
Yes, an eschatological dimension. They believe in seven cycles, culminating in a final savior figure similar to the Mahdi idea, and a final judgment called Pardavari.
Okay, back to the Haftan, the Holy Seven. They govern this inner spiritual realm.
That's their role, yes, overseeing the Batini. And as we said, who makes up the seven changes across the epochs, drawing on figures from Abrahamic, Islamic, maybe even pre-Islamic traditions, again, highlighting that syncretic nature.
Right.
Now, reincarnation Dun Adan. You said it's crucial. Tell us more about that. It seems very distinctive.
It absolutely is. It's a core doctrine. The belief is that the soul goes on a long journey, transmigrating through different forms, starting with inanimate objects, then plants, animals, and finally human forms. This cycle happens over 1,001 lifetimes, or dawns.
1,001 lives. Wow. And the goal?
The ultimate goal is purification and eventually achieving union with Haq, the divine essence. So death isn't really an end. It's just a transition to the next stage of this very long journey.
And your actions in one life affect the next.
Definitely. Salvation is seen as very much an individual responsibility. If you commit sins or act negatively, you might regress in this cycle, maybe come back in a lower form.
So their view of the afterlife is quite different from Islam's eternal heaven or hell.
Very different. They don't really have those concepts in the same way. Part of Mari, that final judgment, seems to be what happens if someone doesn't achieve perfection and union with Hak within those 1,001 lives. It's not about eternal punishment in the same sense. And guiding their actions through these lives are the four pillars. Paki, Rasti, Nisti, Reda.
Yes, those are the ethical foundations. Paki is purity. Rasti is truth or righteousness. Nisti is often translated as nothingness, or perhaps better, ego annihilation, transcending selfish desires, recognizing your dependence on the divine. It's about humility.
Humility, okay.
And Reda covers things like magnanimity, generosity, tolerance. These four pillars are the ethical compass, and they're distinct from the five pillars of Islam, focusing more on internal states and ethical behavior.
Okay, that provides a good sense of their core beliefs. Let's turn to their sacred texts. The Kalam-e-Saranjam is the main one.
It's generally considered the principal holy book, yes. Traditionally, it's attributed to Sultan Sahak himself, compiled around the 15th century. Though it's worth noting, some recent scholarship suggests Saranjam might have originally meant the whole body of teachings from the 4th epoch, rather than one specific book. The big manuscripts we have now might be later collections of those oral traditions.
And what's actually in these columns? What do they cover?
They contain a lot. The history of the Alihak. Details about those epochs of divine manifestation we talked about. Stories and teachings of the avatars and the Haftan. The ethical principles, cosmology, descriptions of rituals, prayers, wisdom. Essentially, the foundations of the faith.
Pirmusi is credited with writing them down.
Traditionally, yes. He's seen as the scribe who recorded these divine narratives. And adherence to what's in the columns is considered really essential for being part of the faith.
You mentioned the language, mostly Gurani, isn't widely spoken now. That must be a challenge.
It really is. The oldest, most sacred texts are in Gurani, including dialects like Harami and Laki. It was like a shared literary language for the community back then. But now, most Hirsani speak Southern Kurdish or Sorani as their mother tongue, so there's a linguistic gap.
So accessing the original meaning is harder.
It can be. While there is religious literature in other languages, including Azeri, Turkic, and Persian, those foundational Gurani texts hold special importance. It creates this interesting tension, deep reverence for the past and the original words, but the practical challenge of making them fully accessible today.
And for centuries, these were passed down orally due to secrecy.
Exactly. Oral transmission was dominant for a long time, partly out of a need for secrecy, maybe persecution fears, but also perhaps a reluctance to commit sacred knowledge to writing.
And getting a single definitive version was difficult.
Yes, the process of creating a fixed canon was complicated. The community is decentralized, organized around those different spiritual lineages, the Khandan. Plus, the belief in ongoing divine manifestation might have played a role. So in the 19th and 20th centuries, different Khandans started compiling their own collections. This led to multiple versions, not one single unified book, creating what some call a cultural diglossia, a split between the old Gurani texts and newer writings in local languages.
So the Kalams aren't just for private study. They're used actively in religious life.
Oh, absolutely integral. They're transmitted within families, taught by the Sayyids, the religious leaders, and they're central to religious gatherings. Rituals, especially the main jam ceremony, are deeply connected to performing and reciting the Kalam.
The Kalam Kwan.
Yes, the singer or chanter of the holy poems. They lead the musical part of the jam, reciting excerpts, usually accompanied by the sacred timbre, the lute. Even the musical pieces themselves are classified based on how sacred they are and what they're used for.
That leads us perfectly into their practices. The jam ceremony sounds like the absolute heart of their communal worship.
It really is. It's a central collective ritual. It takes place in a special meeting house, the jamkhana. You generally need at least 7 adult men. It's supervised by a sayyid. And led musically by the Kalam Kwan.
And women's participation.
Women usually don't participate directly within the main circle itself, though they might be present elsewhere. There's a whole protocol for entering purification, taking off shoes, covering the head, tying the waist. You enter left to right, do a hand-kissing ceremony.
Hand-kissing?
Yes. Sign of respect and community. That everyone sits in a circle facing inwards. This symbolizes equality, and the divine presence is considered to be at the center. You're expected to sit still and be reverent throughout.
And it involves sharing food and drink, and music is key.
Yes. Consecrated water and food are shared, reinforcing community. But the music and chanting of the kalam, the nazam, that's the core. The timbre is essential. It's not just accompaniment. It's considered vital for creating the sacred atmosphere, for connecting with that inner spiritual world, the batini.
Does it get quite intense?
It often involves rhythmic clapping the tempo might build.
Mm-hmm.
It can potentially lead to altered states of consciousness for some participants. It usually ends with a closing announcement or blessing from the Sayyid.
The symbolism seems incredibly powerful. The circle for equality, the shared food for community.
Exactly. And the timbre music as that bridge to the spiritual realm. The whole jam is like a living embodiment of their core beliefs.
Okay, what about joining the faith? How does that happen? The Sarsaporten initiation rite.
Right, Sarsaporten. It literally means entrustment of the head. Sometimes it's called Jazi Sarshikanen, breaking a nutmeg of the head. This is the formal initiation, and it's fundamental, practiced across all the different lineages, the Kandan.
And what does it do?
It formally links the initiate, the Aleb, or Morid, to their specific spiritual master, their peer. This usually happens within a jam ceremony.
Who needs to be there for this?
Quite a few specific roles. You have the initiate, of course, could be a child or an adult convert, depending on the branch. If it's a child, an adult family member acts as their representative, the wakil. Then there's the presiding Sayyidi Sarjam, the initiate's own peer, who must be from a Sayyid family, a dalil, a guide from specific hereditary lines, the dalil's representative, khalifa, the adam, the servant of the jam, their assistant, and the rest of the jam members. And typically, adult women are represented by a male proxy in the ritual itself.
And what actually happens? What are the symbolic parts?
There are several key symbols. A nutmeg, the jaws, represents the head being offered to God and the peer. There's a new white cloth, offerings, niyaz, a sacrifice, dead mat, offered a rooster, a monetary contribution, sarana, a coin, ovesa, a knife, a copper tray.
A lot of specific items.
Yes. During the ceremony, the peer ties the white cloth around the initiate's neck, or the proxies. Prayers are said. Then the peer, or someone representing them, breaks the nutmeg on the coin, declaring the commitment. The nutmeg pieces are then shared out.
And then?
Then the initiate, or proxy, the dalil's representative, and the adam link their clothes together and circle the group, receiving hand kisses while more prayers are recited. It finishes with the white cloth being removed. It's usually given to the dalil and the money being given to the peer.
So it's seen as establishing this really crucial bond.
Absolutely. It's like renewing the original covenant, creating this sacred link between the person, their peer, and the whole community. That peer-murid relationship formed here is just central to everything in your Sani religious life. And, as mentioned, some modern branches, like the Elahi group, reportedly do welcome converts through this right now.
Beyond the jam and initiation, what about other regular observances? Fasting? Pilgrimage.
Yes, both are important. There are two main fasts. First is Kavandan, also called Kawankar or Sawenkar. It's a three-day winter fast, usually late October to mid-November. It remembers Sultan Sahak and his companions being trapped in a cave.
And it's followed by a festival.
Right, the Kavandan Festival, mm-hmm. A time for music, gatherings, honoring God, Kavandag, and Sultan Sahak, discussing the Kalam. The second fast is Qualtas, also 3 days, but in mid-January. It ends with the Qualtas Festival on January 18th, commemorating the resurrection of 7 followers. That involves timbre ceremonies and visiting religious elders. Some think these fasts might have roots in older pre-Islamic, maybe Mithraic, traditions.
And pilgrimage, where do they go?
Visiting the shrine of Sultan Sahak in Purdivar, in Iran, is a really significant obligation, especially for men. Purdivar is the absolute spiritual center. The tomb of Baba Yadgar in Doha is another major sanctuary that people visit.
It also sounds like sacrifices and offerings are quite common.
They are, and often tied to the jam ceremony. There are different types. Niyaz is an offering, usually uncooked food, given when asking for something or showing gratitude. It's also part of the initiation. Qurbani is a votive offering to fulfill a vow. It could be bloodless, like fruit or nutmeg, or a blood sacrifice, usually a young, unblemished male animal.
Like a sheep or goat.
Often, yes. Then there's Kadbat. This is a special meal, often rooster, rice, ghee offered in gratitude, linked to Sultan Sahak's prosperity. The rooster is symbolically important here. Kadbat is also required for initiation.
Any others?
Yes. Nazri is an edible offering made to draw closer to God. Shokrana is a rite of thankfulness, similar to Kadbat. And Abejam is a ritual water distribution in the Jamkhana by the Qadim. Said recall something Sultan Sahak did, maybe related to settling disputes.
Okay, let's shift focus slightly to the social structure. You mentioned this hereditary division early on.
Yes, that's fundamental. There's a clear line between the priestly class, the Sayeds, and the laity, the general followers. And generally, you're born into the community.
And guidance comes from the peer and the Dalil, who are also hereditary roles.
Exactly. Every layperson, the Morid, is expected to have a peer from a Sayed family line. The peer guides their religious life. This bond is inherited and sealed in the Sarsportan rite. The archetype is Peer Benjamin's relationship with the divine.
And the Dalil.
The Dalil, the guide, also comes from specific hereditary families, said to have been chosen by Sultan Sahak. They have a specific role in the initiation ceremony. Dawood Qaswar is seen as the original archetypal Dalil.
But you also mentioned the Datadar, these enlightened individuals. That sounds less hereditary.
It does. The Datadar are people seen as having reached a high level of spiritual insight, perhaps through their own efforts and devotion. So there's this interesting tension, a clear hereditary social structure, but also this theological strand emphasizing the individual's potential for spiritual growth. Some texts might even downplay class distinctions, but the social reality is largely hierarchical.
And the Sayed class itself isn't uniform. It's divided into khandan.
Right. The Sayeds are organized into these lineages or spiritual households called khandan. Most sources mention 12 main ones, each tracing its ancestry back to key figures. You belong to the khandan of your hereditary peer.
So different families like Shah Ibrahimi, Ateshbegi.
Exactly. Those are some prominent ones, along with the Dalil lineages. And there can even be a sort of hierarchy among the khandan themselves. This system creates a somewhat decentralized structure, allowing for variations in traditions and interpretations between different groups. Their separate efforts to write down the kalam, as we discussed, kind of reflect this. It leads to internal diversity.
Geographically, where are your Sanis mainly found?
They're concentrated primarily in the border areas between western Iran and eastern northern Iraq, essentially historical Kurdistan.
So in Iran?
Kermanshah province is a major heartland, especially the Gurani-speaking areas like Sana'a, Sarpoldi, Zahab, Purdivar itself, Dohab. Also regions associated with tribes like the Guran, Sinjabi, Kahlor, Zangana, Jalavand. Lorestan was important early on, too. You also find them in Iranian Azerbaijan, some Turkic-speaking, some Kurdish near Maku, Tabriz, Urmia, and smaller communities elsewhere, like Kurdistan province, Elam, Hamadan, even near Tehran.
And in Iraq, where they're often called Kukai.
Yes. Mainly in the Iraqi Kurdistan region, Erbil, Sulaymaniyah, Halabja areas. Also significantly in Kirkuk Governorate, especially Dakhwark District, Nineveh Governorate on the Nineveh Plains near Mosul, and Diyala Governorate around Khanakin and Mandali.
Are there communities elsewhere?
Historically, smaller groups existed in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. There are links to the Khuzalbash in Turkey. And now there's a diaspora in Western countries like Sweden and Norway.
It sounds like their location in these borderland, often disputed areas makes them quite vulnerable.
It really does. Their geography is unfortunately tied up with conflict, displacement, think the Iran-Iraq war, the recent ISIS violence, and demographic pressures like Arabization policies in parts of Iraq.
Trying to figure out how many Yarsanis or Kakai there actually are seems very difficult.
Extremely difficult. You have the historical tradition of secrecy. They lack official recognition in many places. Some might identify as Muslim for safety or social reasons. Census data just isn't reliable.
So the estimates vary wildly.
Hugely. For Iran, you see figures from maybe 500,000 up to 3 million or even more. If the higher numbers are right, they could be the largest non-Muslim minority there. In Iraq, estimates range from about 110,000 to maybe 300,000. Globally, you might see totals from 2 million up to 7 million, but honestly, the larger figures are pretty speculative. This uncertainty itself really reflects their marginalized position.
And ethnically, they're predominantly Kurdish.
Overwhelmingly. Groups like Guran, Sinjabi, Kahlor, Zangana, Jalalvand, Laki, Shivak, many identify specifically as Guran. But there are non-Kurdish elements too, Turkoman, Azeri communities in both Iran and Iraq, even some Arabic-speaking Kakai in Iraq.
Okay, let's tackle the relationship between Yarsanism and Islam. It sounds complicated.
Complicated is definitely the word. It's marked by shared roots, yes, but also major theological differences leading to misunderstanding, pressure, and sadly, persecution.
Is it seen as a branch of Islam or something separate?
That's debated. Some might view it as an esoteric or gulat offshoot of Shia Islam. Others see it as an independent religion that has absorbed Islamic elements. Given the core theological differences we've discussed, like divine incarnation and reincarnation, most scholars today lean towards seeing it as a distinct tradition, albeit one shaped by its Islamic surroundings.
What are the biggest points of friction, theologically speaking?
Well, number one is divinity. Yarsinism's belief in Mazariyat, divine appearances in human form, directly contradicts the core Islamic principle of Tawhid, God's absolute oneness and transcendence.
No incarnations in Islam.
Right. Then there's eschatology, the end times. Yarsinism's reincarnation cycle, Donan, is fundamentally different from the Islamic belief in one life, resurrection, final judgment, and eternal heaven or hell. Yarsanis don't have those specific concepts of eternal reward or punishment.
Okay, what else?
How they view revelation. Yarsanis believe in ongoing divine manifestations and the authority of their sacred texts, the Kalam. Islam holds that Muhammad is the final prophet and the Quran is the final, complete revelation. And religious law Yarsanis often see their path, Hakikat, as superseding Islamic law, Sharia. Their ethics, rituals, fasts, pilgrimage, even things like appearance norms are different. They don't practice zakat or kums, for instance.
But despite these big differences, there are connections and shared elements.
Oh, yes. They deeply venerate certain Islamic figures, especially Ali, who they see as a primary divine manifestation. Figures like Salman al-Farsi, Kanbar, Fatima are also respected. Some Yarsani groups even incorporate belief in the 12 imams of Shia Islam.
And the Sufi influence.
Very strong. You see it in the terminology peer, murid, tariqa, the master-disciple relationship, and even some similarities between the jam ceremony and Sufi dhikr circles. They share some cosmology, too, like angels Gabriel, Michael, though often reinterpreted within their own system.
Do some Yarsanis identify as Muslim?
Some modernists, or certain lineages like those in Sani, might identify as Shia, or see Yarsanism as the inner esoteric core of Islam. This might be partly a strategy for navigating their minority status, finding some common ground.
This difficult relationship has led to problems with the wider Muslim community.
Sadly, yes. Historically and today, they've often been viewed by mainstream Muslims, Sunni and Shia, through an orthodox lens as heterodox, gulat, or Ali Ilahis, that term they reject. Sometimes even hostile labels like devil worshippers.
Which leads to persecution.
It has, definitely. This perception of being religiously deviant fuels pressure and persecution. In Iran, they're not officially recognized by the constitution. They're often called a misguided cult, or maybe tolerated as a type of Sufism. This lack of recognition means discrimination, vulnerability to blasphemy charges.
Like the Reza Rasai execution.
Exactly, a tragic example in 2024. Arbitrary arrests, detentions on vague charges, social and job discrimination. The mustache issue is a common flashpoint restrictions on practice, incitement by some clerics. It's tough. And for Kurdish Yarsanis, it's often layered with ethnic discrimination, too.
And in Iraq, for the Kakai, they have some recognition.
From the KRG, yes, but not federally. This still leaves them vulnerable. They've been horrifically targeted by extremist Al-Qaeda after 2003, and especially ISIS from 2014 onwards. Threats, kidnappings, assassinations, bombings, forced conversions.
ISIS persecution was particularly bad.
Devastating. Death threats, destruction of shrines and villages, mass displacement from Nineveh Plains and Kirkuk. Returning home has been incredibly hard in security, landmines, destruction, lack of support, militias, land disputes, demographic shifts, plus ongoing societal discrimination, even seizure of some worship places. The whole situation creates this power imbalance, forcing secrecy or adaptation. Their syncretism, ironically, makes them easy targets for misinterpretation and condemnation.
Are there different views within the Yarsani community on how to deal with this, traditionalists versus modernists?
Yes, that's a fair distinction. You have more traditionalist groups, often rural, who really emphasize Yarsanism's distinctness from Islam, holding firm to the old ways. They might be wary of attempts to align too closely with Islam. The Guran group, for example, strongly rejects Shia links, unlike the Sani tradition, which is more accepting.
And the modern.
Often associated with figures like Nur Ali Ilahi and his successors. They tend to articulate beliefs in ways that might seem more compatible with Islamic culture, perhaps focusing on universal mysticism or finding common ground with Shiaism, maybe partly for protection, maybe theological conviction. The Alahi branch is also known for being more open to converts. These internal differences show different strategies for survival and perhaps genuine theological diversity between the Kandan.
Despite all these immense challenges, you said Yarsani culture is vibrant. Music seems key to that resilience.
It's absolutely central. The sacred tanbur, sometimes the daft drum, they aren't just for rituals. They're woven into the fabric of life. There are specific musical modes, maqams, used in ceremonies. Men and women both participate in music, and their communal festivals are vital.
Tell us more about those festivals.
Well, the Kavundun festival, after the autumn fast, is a major one. commemorating Sultan Sahak's deliverance. Big gatherings, music, hymns, rituals, traditional clothes, a real affirmation of community. Then there's Qualta's in January, after its fast, remembering the resurrection of the seven followers. Again, tambur ceremonies, visiting elders.
These events must be crucial for identity.
Hugely important. They reinforce identity and resilience. And, you know, technology helps too. Online platforms let Yarsanas connect, share information, express their identity, build solidarity, especially younger people, across borders.
Even things like the mustache become symbols.
Right. That distinctive handlebar mustache is a visible marker, a statement of identity, even though it can, as we said, lead to discrimination. And the metaphorical language in their texts, it can act like a coded language, preserving their unique beliefs in difficult environments. These cultural expressions are acts of continuity, even resistance.
The human rights situation, though, remains deeply concerning in both Iran and Iraq.
It's extremely serious. In Iran, the lack of constitutional recognition is the root problem. It leads to legal vulnerability, systemic discrimination. They're seen as deviant, their beliefs potentially blasphemous under law, risking severe penalties. Penal code changes have made things worse.
So, arbitrary arrests, unfair trials.
Yes, reports of harassment, detention on vague security charges, unfair trials. Reza Rassi's execution is a chilling reminder. Plus, social and economic discrimination in schools, jobs, restrictions on practicing openly, forced assimilation pressures leading some to emigrate, and for Kurds, it's double discrimination, ethnic and religious. All this happens in Iran's wider context of severe human rights restrictions.
And in Iraq, for the Kakai, even with KRG recognition.
Federal non-recognition limits their rights and protection. They've been brutally targeted by extremists, Al-Qaeda, then ISIS. Threats, killings, kidnappings, bombings, forced conversion attempts, mass displacement.
And return is difficult.
Incredibly so. Insecurity, mines, destruction, lack of services, obstruction, land disputes, demographic changes. It's a huge challenge. Plus ongoing societal discrimination, harassment, insults, even seizure of worship places. Politically, lack of federal recognition means less protection, no reserved seats in the KRG parliament like some other minorities get. It's an existential threat to their identity and heritage. Again, part of Iraq's broader struggle with minority rights and human rights abuses.
Has the international community taken notice?
Yes, there have been significant international scrutiny. Reports from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, UN bodies, USCIRF, Minority Rights Group, US State Department. They all document the persecution, discrimination, violence, lack of recognition, restrictions on freedom of religion.
What do these reports highlight?
In Iran, the systemic discrimination due to lack of legal protection, arbitrary detention, unfair trials, executions. In Iraq, the devastating impact of ISIS, the insecurity, the displacement and return challenges, societal and institutional discrimination. The UN investigated ISIS crimes against minorities, including Kakai.
And what do they call for?
Policy reforms, investigations, accountability, greater protection for minorities in both countries. The fact that Yarsanas and Kakai feature in these reports really underlines their vulnerability and the urgent need for international attention and advocacy.
Well, this exploration into Yarsanism certainly reveals a complex, fascinating tapestry of beliefs and practices, clearly shaped by centuries of interaction. From that unique cosmology, Sultan Sahak's central role, to their distinct ethics, it's a unique religious identity.
Absolutely. But what also comes through so strongly is the sheer precarity these communities face. The constant struggle to maintain their traditions against discrimination, violence, lack of recognition. It's a really concerning picture. It highlights just how urgently we need greater understanding and real protection for minority religious rights in the region.
This journey into the Kurdish Research Audio Archive has hopefully given everyone a valuable overview and maybe sparked some curiosity about this often overlooked tradition and the very real struggles its people face today. We definitely encourage listeners to explore the resources further and maybe reflect on the broader questions this raises about religious freedom and minority rights.